Good morning. Walk around Honolulu and it's clear new buildings are changing the look of streets and skylines. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Today, architect David Byland considers the aesthetic of design as the city continues to grow. Meanwhile, UHERO released its construction report this morning. Director Carl Bonham looks at how last year's expectations match the reality and where we go from here. It's Friday, March 27th. From HPR2, it's The Conversation.
And actor Crispin Helion Glover has forged an eclectic career that includes children's books and directing some decidedly offbeat movies of his own. He's with us in our studio. And it's described as an Indian version of feng shui. Kavita Chibber introduces us to the science and art of Vastu Shastra.
We'll talk right after a look at today's headlines. Good morning and welcome to an Aloha Friday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This is The Conversation, and you are Chris Vandercook.
I always am. Always will
really?
Be.
Really? Sometimes I think there are other people who lurk inside.
Lurking
there.
Inside, yes.
One Pepe Le Pew, for example.
For example, yeah.
That's an old joke that we've had going for a long time.
That's
you do
right.
The best
that
Pepe Le Pew
right. Yes.
Of anyone I know. But here we are on a Friday, and we're looking at ideas of what we see in our community and what may be some of the realities that are behind it in terms of the data. And it's not necessarily the same thing. Often expectations with many things don't sync with research, and you could make that argument about public perception too. Today's construction report from the UH Economic Research Organization turns on that point. What has appeared to be rapid growth, the cranes and the condo towers in Honolulu, for example, looks different next to the actual data. UHERO director Carl Bonham came into the studio earlier, and he put it this way.
Construction is not nearly as strong as the public thinks it is, and it's not nearly as weak as the economists think it is, because the economists are all looking at the data, the public is all looking at the cranes. And they look out their windows and they see all these cranes and they assume that there's this enormous amount of activity going on. And it is an enormous amount of activity for Kakaako relative to what we've, you know, been accustomed to. And then the economists look at the data and, for instance, you look at residential building permits. Well, they fell last year. Now, that's kind of hard to understand, right? Can you really believe that there was a decline in permitted residential building last year?
Especially as you're seeing all of those buildings go up in Kakaako.
Exactly. And the answer is probably not. As best we can tell, the answer is it takes a very long time between when a permit is applied for and when it's actually issued on high-rise residential towers. That's less true for the base, the superstructure that they put in at the beginning of a project. So you take a project like the Symphony. They're obviously putting up apartment buildings, condo buildings. They put the superstructure in and they put the glass condos on top of it, or glass surrounded condos. But there's been no permit issued for the residential side of that tower. It's been applied for, and presumably there are tentative approvals or whatever. There's a conversation going on. But the residential side of these buildings are sometimes taking 300 to 400 days to get the permit actually issued.
So that's a big lag between when we hear about the building possibly going up,
right,
and then you see it start, but then it sort of stops for a while.
Well, the data flow stops. The building is going on. And what that means for us is that these permits, at least for the high-rise construction, aren't a very good leading indicator. If anything, they're a lagging indicator. So we're going to get permit numbers this year that we think are really going to reflect activity that started last year. And so the construction cycle is stronger than the data suggests. And there's also problems with the tax-based data. There could be some problems even in the jobs data where some construction workers may not be getting counted as construction workers because companies that they work for are processing all of their HR data through another company. And so they may actually be showing up in the official statistics as something other than a construction worker.
Carl Bonham, isn't there also an issue with what's counted as being residential and what's not residential. I mean, looking at those apartment buildings and towers going up in Kaka'ako, for all the world, someone would look at that and say, oh, look, that's residential. But that doesn't seem to be translated into the data.
Well, the initial phase of that building is all non-residential. So the parking structure, the superstructure where there's offices, there probably retail also, that all gets counted as non-residential. Now, an example actually of something that's clearly residential that's not counted that way is the work that has been done on top of Ala Moana. So anything that's going on top of the, whether it's the parking garage or, you know, a retail outlet, is actually getting permitted as additions and alterations. So these are additions to the parking structure, but they're clearly residential. And so that's another example of where
perception doesn't quite meet with what's happening with the data.
I mean, we are building more residential units than the data suggests. But no matter how you slice it, last year was still a little bit weaker than, I think, perception, and then certainly weaker than any of the forecasters thought. Some of that's going to show up this year as the data sort of catches up. We think that we'll have modest growth, you know, kind of growing to moderate. What that does is that it pushes the cycle out a little bit further. So when you don't get this real big booming peak, you don't get as much cost pressure as fast. And it takes longer sort of for prices to kill off the activity, both on the demand side and the supply side. One other factor that we haven't talked about yet is the effect of rail. And in 2014, there were supposed to be 9 stations under construction, right? There were 9 stations in the first package that went out to bid, and that all got canceled, right? And we still haven't heard who the winning bidder is for the 3-station package, right? So one of the things that we've done in this forecast process is we've taken that into account so that you essentially, in the original plans for rail, there was this very rapid ramp up of activity that, you know, got you to a point where, you know, you were doing something on the order of 2 to 3 towers per year for rail. In other words, the equivalent of 2 to 3 condo towers of rail each year. You know, that rapid ramp up means you've got to bring on more people, and it drives up costs. It does contribute to higher costs. It would have resulted in a larger increase in job counts and in overall activity. Now what we've got is we've kind of got it just more spread out. Whether or not we finish on time is another question, you know, another issue. And fortunately, that's not in the time horizon on this forecast.
But what still is a big question for a lot of people is what may happen with Ho'opili and Koa Ridge.
Yes, absolutely. That's in the courts. They're waiting decisions. You know, it's a very interesting problem. On the one hand, there is a strong desire to preserve, and you know, it is in the Constitution. I actually saw something in the news. There were going to be some meetings on designating important ag lands. So there's this strong desire to preserve agricultural lands. On the other hand, we've got to build houses for our children or for us. And if we don't, then we're going to continue to see prices rise. Even if we do, we're going to continue to see prices rise. And the question is sort of how rapidly do those prices increase? You know, if you look at just Oahu, we need to build about 4,000 housing units per year. And we haven't done that in years. Even if you did all of Ho'opili and all of Koa Ridge and all of Kaka'ako, you know, you're just sort of barely keeping up with the housing that's needed just to keep up with population growth.
And that has nothing to do with the issue of affordability, which is a whole other part of
the equation. Well, it's sort of not directed at, say, workforce housing, right? But it contributes to affordability in the sense that if you don't build that stuff, prices are
going to shoot upwards.
Yeah. I mean, you simply will have inadequate supply to meet demand, and prices will go up even more. The fact that we're starting to see rental units being built, which is really interesting because that's not a feature of Honolulu. It is a feature of most major cities, New York or San Francisco or other places, where you actually build rental apartments. And there's a project, Forest City has a project in Kapolei. I think it's called the Kapolei Lofts. And there are a couple of projects in Kaka'ako. I've kind of speculated with my colleagues. I haven't talked much with developers about this yet, but I wonder whether when the cycle sort of starts to taper off here, or when the economy starts to weaken a little bit, whether we won't see some shift in that mix more towards the rental market. Again, that's just speculation, but I think that's a possibility. If you look at the, you know, the longer term data, so you don't go to sort of get bogged down in what happened last year. If you look at the longer term data, we're at very near record lows of building. Now, granted, we don't need to build quite as much as we did 30, 40 years ago or 20 to 30 years ago when population was growing even faster, but we do have a problem of not producing enough housing.
Let's shift for a second because we haven't yet talked about CIP projects and what's been going on in the government sector or, frankly, what's been happening in the neighbor islands.
So the neighbor islands are still sort of bouncing along the bottom. They did show some growth, in particularly in residential permits in last year. If you look at the dollar growth there, it was largely because of some fairly high-end houses, permits for high-end construction on the Big Island. There's not a large amount of activity on the neighbor islands. There is activity in the, something else we haven't talked too much about is
the telescope.
Telescope, one on Maui, the TMT starting up. The other thing that is going on that's having a fairly large impact on activity right now is in the hotel resort space and in the retail space. Now, again, that's mostly centered on Oahu, but, you know, there is activity on the neighbor islands. There have been some redevelopments. There's a Marriott planned on Maui. It's not huge numbers, but we are seeing them come off the bottom and add some to job growth. So it's stabilizing. On Oahu, in that resort space, there's a lot of activity going on. You know, you've got multiple projects in Waikiki, redevelopment of the international marketplace, condo towers going up, the Ritz. You've got the Ohana West, I think it is, being taken out for redevelopment. The Ihilani is taken out for redevelopment. And those are big projects. On the government side, that one's a little harder. I mean, last year, normally in an election year, you see an uptick in government contracts awarded.
But we had that more like, what, in
2013?
2013, right.
Yeah. Some of these shifts can also be related to federal spending. And, you know, we've seen sequestration had a large bite in Hawaii. We've lost federal government jobs in large numbers in 2013 and in 2014. The state seems to be looking at sort of new CIP projects and saying, you know, costs are rising, private sector is going strong, you know, we have a relatively tight budget, let's not go crazy and kind of fall back to sort of more normal levels. And that's sort of what we've got in our forecast is government contracts in the $1 billion range every year. So not a whole lot of activity there. So I'm not sure I wouldn't really count TMT as government, right? That's a consortium. I don't know what you would call that.
Jobs for some people.
Yes. You know, when you look at the total price tag of TMT, fair amount of that is for activity other than constructing things in Hawaii. But all in, it's positive for construction jobs. And longer term, you know, hopefully positive for fairly well-paying innovation jobs. Maybe not large numbers, but numbers that are important for the Big Island and important for our children.
So just to capitalize with all of this, Carl, as you look at the coming year and those people who have been waiting for construction to pop, well, clearly they're not going to get that, but they may get something that keeps them chugging along for longer than the peaks would indicate if, you know, we had a peak situation happen again. Is that something that should be incorporated into the way we look at a lot of things regarding the economy, not looking for these big pops, but really looking at it to be chugging along nicely for the people who are involved with it? And maybe that doesn't mean that everybody who had a job in construction gets to have another one, but that it's a more desirable position for us to be in?
Well, there's a very high cost to volatility and to big swings. And so, yes, I mean, if we could somehow or other orchestrate a Goldilocks economy with, you know, just the right amount of growth that never gets too hot or too cold, that would be great. This is just a forecast,
yeah.
Right? Hopefully we get a little bit more growth than we're predicting, but it doesn't go crazy. You know, the cycle will end. It will end more than likely because of one or two factors. You know, the global economy or the U.S. economy go into recession, or we get price pressure here that outstrips our ability to purchase. So we don't build enough housing. The economy continues to grow. Demand goes up. Home prices go up faster and faster to higher levels, and it just squeezes more and more people out of the market, and it gets to the point where there aren't any buyers.
Or not buyers from here. They may be buyers from elsewhere, which would change literally the complexion of our population.
Those things will go hand in hand. If prices were to double, say, from where they are now, which is possible, it's happened before, that would squeeze out multiple types of buyers. Right? It wouldn't just be squeezing out local buyers, but it certainly would create serious affordability problems. So yes, if we can get sort of just enough growth long term, it's better for the construction workers. It's better for the average person on the street who would like to be able to find a apartment or a condo or something like that.
On that positive note, well, thank you very much for coming in and joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Carl Bonham is the UH Economic Research Organization's Executive Director and Professor of Economics. He was a founding member of UHERO in 1997. His research includes macroeconomics, applied econometrics and forecasting, tourism economics, and the Hawaii economy.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:19, and later in the show, actor Crispin Glover delves into a wide variety of media, and he's bringing his work to downtown Honolulu. He's in our studio with us, but first, your quiz.
For today's backyard quiz, we're looking for the name of a man who became the key advisor to Kamehameha I and helped him consolidate his rule over the entire island chain. This man's major asset was his knowledge of European weaponry and tactics, and his principal motivation may have been simply staying alive. He was the sole survivor of a massacre of the crew of the schooner Fair American by a rival Hawaiian chieftain. He had been tied to a canoe and left for dead, but he pulled through and ended up becoming a valued member of Kamehameha's retinue, attaining the rank of high chief and marrying into the king's family. He became known to Hawaiians as Aikake, but he was actually born in Wales. So, what was the given name of this adventurous soul who had a powerful impact on late 18th century Hawaii? Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you think you know the answer. And the first person with the correct one gets an HPRT.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Whole Foods Market Hawaii, Ferraro Choi, and Ulupono Initiative.
Crispin Helion Glover is an actor who's been able to take the creative freedom that comes with early success and branch out into directing, writing children's books, and producing the kind of films whose audience is looking for something far from the mainstream. He's in Honolulu for a presentation of his work in a variety of media. He's with us in our studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here. There's one thing that's funny that you said that I write children's books, but they're definitely not children's books. Some of them are from old children's books that were written in the 1800s, but I've taken old books from the 1800s and reworked them and turned them into different books from what they originally were. They're heavily illustrated. I have a couple here.
Are they still
right
for
now.
Children?
No, they're probably not for children. Uh-huh. I mean, for the most part, they would be okay if children saw them. But my shows are, I'll be performing here in Honolulu. I have 8 different books that the heavily illustrated pages are projected behind me. And then I dramatically narrate these books.
And the pages look as if they'd benefit from dramatic narration, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah. The show works well. I've been performing it for many years.
Yeah.
And then I started distributing my feature films that I've directed by having a live tour with them. And I'm proud of the show.
Well, Crispin, let's talk about what I might call, I guess, the preoccupations of your film.
Yeah.
You have a real determination to move your work in a different, non-traditional direction. How would you describe it?
Well, the very first film, What Is It?, which I'll be showing on the second night on Saturday night, most of the actors in the film have Down syndrome, but the film is not about Down syndrome at all. What it really is my psychological reaction to the corporate constraints that have happened in the last 35 years of film or so, wherein anything that can possibly make an audience member uncomfortable is necessarily excised, or that film will not be corporately funded or distributed.
Yeah.
I think it's a very damaging thing, because it's that moment when an audience member sits back in their chair, looks up at the screen, and thinks to themselves, is this right what I'm watching? Is this wrong what I'm watching? Should I be here? Should the filmmaker have done this? What is it?
And it moves them to a level of involvement.
Exactly.
That they might not otherwise have had.
Exactly.
Because,
yeah.
Because the whole Hollywood mechanism, which I'm sure you know well, is one of creating a kind of a soothing, affirming environment where
it often can, yes.
You're okay, everything's okay, let's not get excited, right?
And more specifically, not having people ask questions.
Yeah.
Because if people are informed and ask questions, it could ultimately go against what corporate interest is. Corporate interests are enjoying what people are allowing them to control and do. But if we really have informed and thoughtful people, corporations could be serving humans as individuals as opposed to individuals being constrained by corporate interests.
And I think
exactly. And that's exactly what's happening in our corporate media right now. And it is something that I'm glad. I've been touring with this film for 10 years, and I'm glad to see that when I first started touring with it, I had a lot more upset. We were talking about Buñuel outside
Luis
earlier.
Luis Buñuel, yeah.
And his films, when they were originally shown, people were very upset about things. But a lot of those things have been properly addressed in culture, and they're in some ways considered quaint now. But it's very important for questions and things that people need to be reacting to so culture can continue to positively move forward.
Well, there's a long tradition, Crispin, of artists who, like Luis Buñuel, the Spanish film director you described, who set out to shock, to shake things up, right? And now Buñuel is considered practically mainstream, when in fact he was, considered quite offensive when he first premiered a lot of his work. I'm thinking particularly of the things he did with Salvador Dali.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you could take some of those things that were in his films, and if they were still put into a film in a certain way, they would they could have an equivalent kind of upset. But I'm sometimes people accuse my films of being there just for that reason. Mm-hmm. But I've been touring with the film. I don't have the films out. I have a second film I should talk about as well. But I don't I don't solely have the films out just to upset. This is why I tour with it, and I have a Q&A after the film shows that goes about an hour and a half, because people, well, they do have a lot of questions, and they question me, particularly with the first film. And
What kind of questions? I mean, what are they?
The film deals in areas of taboo in such a way that it's not something that people are used to seeing, the juxtaposition of the imagery and thoughts behind it are things that sometimes, not everybody, but sometimes people become very upset about. Yeah. And so I'm there to have a discussion with them. That's particularly the first film. The second film, called It Is Fine, Everything Is Fine, it's part one, two of a trilogy.
Right.
I'm actually showing them in reverse order Friday night. Tonight, yeah. I will be showing It Is Fine, Everything Is Fine, which was written by one of the people that's in the first film. His name was Stephen C. Stewart. He'd been born with a severe case of cerebral palsy. And when he was in his early 20s and his mother died, he was placed into a nursing home where he really did not want to be. He was difficult to understand what he was saying, and the people that were taking care of him there would derisively call him an MR, a mental retard, which is not a nice thing to say to anybody. But Steve was of normal intelligence, and the emotional turmoil that he must have gone through for the decade he was in that nursing home, I can't even begin to imagine. When he got out, he wrote this screenplay in the style of a 1970s TV murder mystery movie of the week, wherein he's the bad guy. And because he wrote it in this genre style, as opposed to a standard autobiography, there are certain truths in his life that stand out in a very beautiful fashion. And I'm really proud of this film.
Let me ask you a question before we run out of time.
Sure.
When people are in the Q&As after these films, when people are shocked, offended, troubled,
it's not always the case.
When they are,
sure.
How do you explain it to them, and do they come around? Do they?
It all depends. I mean, for the most part, people are very happy to have seen the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, both of the films sit in an area where there are some people that this is not what they enjoy.
Do they feel better about it after they've talked to
many you? People do. I mean, if there is that discomfort, many people do start to have a certain thought process. Sometimes there are people just know this is not what they like, which is okay. You know, I never get upset when people are upset by it. I'm just glad that there's a discussion that's starting.
But it's important to you that somebody is operating out at these fringes, right?
How do you mean?
Out at the fringes of acceptable, or the fringes of comfortable, the fringes of what?
I think it's important that there's true thought, that people are thinking about things. The first film is very strongly a reaction to corporate control. The second film, because Steve was in a very specific situation, he was reacting to something else, and in a certain way, there's a more universal message that comes through, and it's very specific to this particular person. But it's something I'm the most proud of that film of anything I've done in my whole career. It's just something. There's a catharsis with his character that is quite beautiful, and I'm looking forward to showing it to the Hawaiian audiences here. It'll be very interesting to see.
Catharsis being a very significant goal of art. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That really seems to be where you're going with your work.
Absolutely. And talking about the surrealists, they understood that on a deep level, having recognized what utilizing Freud's understanding of getting into the subconscious.
Yeah.
Was where good art comes from.
Well, it's going to continue to.
Yes.
Thanks very much.
Well,
thanks for
having me. I really appreciate it.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
Crispin Helion-Glover is an actor and director who will screen two of his films, What Is It? And It's Fine, Everything Is Fine, tonight and tomorrow at Next Door in downtown Honolulu. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
We know the facts about climate change, but now a scientist and a ballet choreographer have teamed up to make us feel it. I'm Ira Flatow on the next Science Friday. Can dance change the conversation about global warming? Plus, famed psychologist Michael Gazzaniga has us thinking out of both sides of our brains. All on the next Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
Contributions for Challenge 2015 support the purchase, creation, and delivery of HPR's services to the station's 175,000 weekly statewide listeners. We gratefully acknowledge Glenn Silva of Hilo, Monica Stittberg of Kaneohe, and James Yoshida of Honolulu. Thank you all for your early gifts. When it comes to pledge drives, it's never a matter of if we'll reach the goal, it's when. Early giving can mean fewer on-age pledge drives and pledge drive days, I should say. It's all your call. Many first-time givers are choosing the convenience of HPR's $10 a month sustaining member program. You can find a secure donation form on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local, national, and international news programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com. Support for today's programming comes from Diamond Head Theater, presenting Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific, on stage now through April 19th. Tickets at DiamondHeadTheater.com.
On our Friday agenda is always a look at what's coming out of our news department come Monday. And we've got News Director Bill Dorman here with us to talk a little trash.
Yeah, good morning, Bethann. You know, we got a series going on next week. The topic may not sound sexy on the face of it, but it's one of these things that's of critical importance to the islands. Opala, garbage, gomi, whatever you want to call it, we're calling it trashing paradise. And it's a closer look at everything from landfills through some other policy choices that are coming up and that are in action now. I know we're going to talk in more detail about this on Monday, but I can tell you a little bit about some of what we're going to be looking at. Waimanalo Gulch, of course, the sole municipal landfill here in Oahu. Wayne Yoshioka spent some time up there. H-Power here not far away. Molly Solomon spent some time there. Brings up the whole issue of what they call waste to energy, which is a very complex piece of this. There are proposals and plans related to this on Maui, on the Big Island, and H-Power, of course, is here expanding. It all stems from a bit of what, boy, seems like a great idea. What if we could just take trash, burn it, produce energy, and everything would be clean and wonderful and energy efficient and economically sound and great?
But sometimes good ideas are just good ideas.
Well, it's and the realities often are a lot more complicated. And so part of what we're going to be doing is breaking down some of the complexities on this. And again, it's not that we have all the answers on this, but we do have some of the questions. And we're also looking broadly past Oahu. Noe Tanigawa is taking a look at the situation on Kauai. Eileen Chow is going to have an update from Maui. I'm going to take a look at some of the economics and a bit of the history involved in all of this. So, again, that's all next week. We'll be doing that.
And you and I are going to sit down and have a fuller, richer conversation about the series come Monday
as
well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so you'll be back. I'll see you then. Have a good weekend.
You bet. You too.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. Also on a Friday, we check your letters and email. And on Monday, we posted a Facebook query about a hiking website causing a stir. Bloggers claim it's free speech to write about the illegal Kamehameha Ridge Trail. David Kalanikapu Kopp wrote, "I'm all for free speech and transparency. However, if I owned a private property, I would want those trespassers held accountable. I'd feel as if photos of my property, which could only be taken by trespassing into my private property, should be removed. Perhaps they need a better gate or guard."
Johann Peter Lall had this to say, "Free speech is a right, but trespassing isn't. Why don't they just arrest people who trespass, including the blogger?" And Dave Endo added, "I say if these people trespass, they have no right to sue anyone if they get hurt. In addition, they should pay for the rescue efforts. I don't believe first responders should have to put themselves in harm's way for some idiot's thrill-seeking." And this week on our talkback line, we heard this.
"My name is Bud Weisbart, and I'm calling regarding the program that dealt with the relations of the United States and Thailand. As the other two callers, Friday the 13th, mentioned, I am also a Peace Corps volunteer, formerly at the same period of time, 1963 through 65. And I think that what the professor said, as John indicated in his comments, is a little bit maybe skewed to the military point of view in Thailand right now. It's easy to forget that during World War II, Thailand actually declared war on the United States. So we certainly didn't have a 200-year history of smooth sailing. And Thailand, of course, has had a number of dictatorships, mostly through military, as well as through some democratic elections, but not until after 1965. So I think it's important to know that. I would love to be in touch with the former Peace Corps colleagues. My name again is Bud Weisbart, and I was in Thai Group 5. Thank you."
"Yes, I'm calling about the woman who was applying for a city and county job on Oahu. She's not really suffering. The lawyer used that word explicitly, like suffering, suffering. Suffering is losing an advantage or like losing your child or something, not because you have to shishin it up. Outrageous language, as typical lawyer stuff. Right, bye."
"My name is Michelle Grothstein. I'm calling from Kaneohe. My son works in Austin, Texas for a small limousine company, and his income was devastated last year at the South by Southwest event, which is one of the biggest events of the year in Austin, because of rideshare like Uber. It would be a disaster to let Uber into Honolulu and not subject them to the same regulations that other cab companies and other transportation companies are already subject to. I do not see this as being a benefit to anybody but Uber. Thank you very much for letting me share that information. Bye."
And thanks for the letters. Our new talkback line is 792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you prefer Facebook, we're there too. Just look for us as Hawaii Conversation. Earlier today, we talked with UHERO Executive Director Carl Bonham about perceptions of construction in Hawaii versus the realities. One reality now completed is a building on Kapi'olani in Honolulu. It caused quite a stir with its sleek glass exterior that seems to lean into the airspace above the sidewalk. A rich conversation on Facebook brought out several ideas on how Honolulu is developing and the aesthetic principle guiding it, which we thought might make a good conversation for all of us. We asked Architects Hawaii principal David Bylan to weigh in, and he joins us now in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, we should say at the outset that the Walgreens building, which is the one that we're talking about, was an Architects Hawaii project, not yours per se. But did you hear a lot of conversation about that too, as we saw was happening on Facebook?
Oh, yes. We have a lot of discussions and points of view about How modern should it be? How traditional should it be? Especially as it's being built and people are imagining what it will be.
For most people who are just walking around and honestly don't know the difference between, you know, Beaux-Arts and Bauhaus, it just doesn't, you know, register. But when something strikes them as, wait a minute, that might be out of character, or I'm not expecting that, those perceptions all have to be looked at and considered as we move Hawaii into a ever-changing modern era. How do you balance the need for feeling like this is our town still with it's still got to grow?
There's a lot of newness that comes with all of this growth. And for us, and as one looks at even at the Walgreens building, we see that we're trying very hard to have one foot in the history of the place and of Hawaii and its landscape and the new requirement. I mean, Walgreens wanted a flagship store that would invite people in and be interesting and spark conversation. So we look to history, but we look to what's going on right now. It's a modern moment, it's a modern use, and it's a bit new. So we try to find the history and the newness at the same time.
Okay, when you walk into that building, for example, and not to, you know, beat this over the head.
That's okay.
But it's not something that would maybe speak to most people as having historical significance. I mean, it's very modern. It's very cool. When you stand on the second floor and you almost feel like you're over the sidewalk, it's a very different kind of building. But I don't get a lot of sense of history when I walk into
interesting,
that.
Yes. So it's very interesting to look at it and look at some of the forms. So, for example, overhead, there are canopies that have some angled elements that kind of weave together. Well, our designers, and Lester Eng is our senior designer who led the team for this project, our designers looked at the history of the place and, you know, Ala Moana, the way to the sea. This was a place of canoes and canoe building, of course, because for the fishermen, and a connection within the Ahupua'a that it sits in. So those stories became inspirations for expressing in a kind of direct, a little bit fun way, the nets of the fishermen. And even the big shape of the roof is like the hale, the traditional hale that the type of hale that was used for the canoe building, opened up and made kind of more expressive and modern.
So take that and now apply that to some of the other buildings that you know are on the drawing board and how that aesthetic may be guiding what we may see in a couple of years.
Well, we look to, and I think other designers in Hawaii do that too. It's really important. The designers here know this history and know how to learn and know who to talk to. And each place, each project inspires differently. So we're very fortunate we're working on a new courthouse in Kona, for example, right now. And it's a public building. It's judicial. It has a very specific kind of serious but social requirement, a civic requirement. And the place that is being built in Kona has stories. That Ahupua'a is vastly different from the one that goes through Kaka'ako. So we look to the history of that place. There's the legend of the splintered paddle, which goes back many, many, many generations in traditional culture and connects to ideas of law. So we look to those, and then the building form and the graphics, the art, the public art, all of those come together to reflect some of these connections to the place and the past.
So how do you sort of give advice about looking at your city with modern eyes and yet maybe sort of a historical heart when people are walking around and feeling like, I've lived here all my life and it doesn't look like my town anymore?
I love that question because I too, it's how do I look at new buildings or buildings under design? One thing I look for, buildings that there are parts of them, it might be the public space, it might be the landscape, it might be the art and the graphics, that can only be here. So while the materials of new buildings might be metal and glass because that's the world we live in right now, when the forms, the artwork, tell a story, relate to being in Hawaii, that's when I think things become specifically Hawaiian. The history, the tradition, we all love the buildings of the territorial era, and those were wonderful buildings. They still are, and they are buildings of that time. They express things. You can read those buildings.
I wish we had more time, David. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
David Byland is a principal with Architects Hawaii. He heads the firm's healthcare studio, the Sustainability and Architecture Program, and is the director of design. His portfolio includes the Ronald T. Y. Moon Judiciary Complex, the University of Hawaii Johnny Burns School of Medicine, and the Kameda Medical Center in Japan.
And I am nothing of a builder, but here I dreamt I was an architect. And I built this balustrade to keep you home, to keep you safe from the outside world. Never seemed to meet, the structure fell about our feet, and we were free to go.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name the Welshman who was the sole survivor of the massacre of the crew of the schooner Fair American, who brought his knowledge of European-style war-making to the armies of Kamehameha I. In the early 19th century, he became a high chief and governor of the island of Oahu. He was murdered in 1810, but not before he'd married into Hawaiian royalty. After Davis's death, his friend John Young, a fellow advisor to Kamehameha, raised his children and managed his estate. His Hawaiian name was Aikake, but as we said, he was born Isaac Davis in Wales.
And we heard from Mary Sanford in Honolulu, who knew that answer. Thank you so much. A tea will be on your way.
And it's now 8:51. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
How much do the spaces around us affect our moods, our behavior, our sense of well-being? Devotees of feng shui would argue more than we know. That's an ancient study that the West is only now beginning to understand, but Kavita A. Chibber is a practitioner of Vastu Shastra, an older system from India that's described as an Indian version of feng shui. She's in town to teach a workshop called Ancient Wisdom, Modern Solutions, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Kavita.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Could you give me kind of a working definition of Vastu?
The word Vastu actually means a dwelling.
Uh-huh.
And Shastra is the Vedic literature which gives you information on architectural space and design and the optimum way to balance the elements with your own life and to bring about the optimum results of abundance and prosperity.
It's very easy for a discussion like this to get into a very sort of airy-fairy, ephemeral language, but yes. you're really taking a kind of a science-based approach, aren't
yes.
you?
Vastu Shastra is actually very scientific, and the ancient spiritual masters from India actually studied astronomy, physics, geometry, the geomancy, Earth's vibratory rays, and then put it all together along with a study of Ayurveda and yoga to create the optimal space for the inhabitants of that space to fulfill their lives and to achieve their goals in the best possible way. The premise of Vastu Shastra is that our body is made of five elements, and so is the Earth's energy. So if we work in harmony with nature, we will benefit. And when we go against nature, we don't. In the old days, the structures were built from natural ingredients. Now we have a lot of artificial, structures, things that we use to build a home or to build any kind of space.
Natural ingredients and ingredients from the area, right?
That's
so that
correct.
You would build from the mud around your
yes.
house, quite literally.
Yes. And there were also very clean, sleek lines. They were divided into different zones. And, they were very, very specific information on where, say, the master of the house would sleep, and the reason for that, where the entrance of the house would be, what are the spaces that impact different areas of your body, and if there is any kind of energetic blockage, that will impact that area adversely.
And what are the things that block energy?
So the first thing is it's just the structure of the space. You know, if it doesn't follow simple, sleek lines, there will be, you know, pillars and any kind of objects, furniture that you place incorrectly that can stop the energy from flowing smoothly within the environment. In Vastu Shastra, the soil is really important. You know, the kind of soil that you have, what are the structures around you, they take all that into account. And then they look at the area, the geographic area. And it's kind of interesting to note that, you know, people who live in different geographical areas, their facial features kind of resemble, even if they're from different cultural or ethnic backgrounds. And the reason for that is that the soil does have an impact on the person's facial features as you go down, you know, many generations later.
You mentioned elements that are very, very important in Vastu Shastra that are now don't get much attention. Has a lot of ancient wisdom been just abandoned for one reason or another?
I'm so glad you mentioned that. Yes, it has. And I think, you know, we really have to get back to the basics because it's very pertinent and it really holds true in every walk of life. Even if you look at the architectural structures of ancient times, whether it's the pyramids or it's the Taj Mahal, they were all constructed according to Vastu Shastra. And because there was an interaction in ancient civilizations between each other, and Emperor Ashoka from India was a renowned emperor, actually sent people to Southeast Asia and East Asia to teach them, you know, how to live their lives well.
This knowledge found its way to Egypt.
It found its way to Egypt. It found its way to ancient Greece. It found its way to China because that's where feng shui evolved.
Yeah.
Chinese monks came, to India, and then there were businessmen who came on the Silk Road. And so that's where they picked up the information, which was oral tradition, and then applied it to the geographical conditions of China. So old traditional feng shui has 50-60% of its principles based on Vastu. The rest of it was fixed according to the geography of China. So, for example, according to the Indian Vastu Shastra, an east entrance or a north entrance is auspicious, but it's not so in China because, from Mongolia, the winds and the sands come in. So there's so much more to discuss in it, but people are getting interested and they're getting back to it. And
that's let's hope we all benefit from it. And thanks very much for coming in and talking with
pleasure.
Us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Kavita A. Chibber is a practitioner of Vastu Shastra, an ancient system from India, that's described as an Indian version of feng shui. She's offering a workshop called Ancient Wisdom, Modern Solutions next Saturday, April 4th, at the Still and Moving Center in Honolulu. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
I'm going to go home and look at my house in a whole new way.
Well, I live in clutter, so I know that there's a lot to it because my energy's blocked all kinds of ways.
Well, that's going to do it for this week. Coming on Monday, though, we're going to have a conversation about homelessness with LA Times reporter Steve Lopez. You might remember him from the film The Soloist.
And a student science prodigy explores the ways we react to color. Your executive producer of the show is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Taylor Rice is our production assistant.
The Backyard Quiz theme is written for us by John DeMello. And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you back here on Monday when we pick up the conversation.